Well, on a day where a verdict came down in a attempted assassination on the gunman of Donald Trump, the speaking and addressing the UN, a Tiger's epic collapse, the number one story is the return to late night for Jimmy Kimmel.
As I was saying before I was interrupted, if you're just joining us, we are preempting your regularly scheduled encore episode of Celebrity Family Feud to bring you this special report. I'm happy to be here tonight with you.
Now, I have a friend who was on Family Feud, and I think Jimmy Kimmel should be fired for disparaging Family Feud.
I think so. Yeah, absolutely. I agree. 100%.
Lloyd Jackson, J.B. Edmonds. Lloyd, you were on the show.
I was. Yeah. 100%.
Not Kimmel.
No, on the Feud, not Kimmel.
Yeah, you don't want to be on Kimmel right now.
No, it's a little too soon.
Yeah. A little too touchy.
Yeah.
What did you guys make of Jimmy Kimmel's comeback here last night?
Well, let me tell you, he did not stay away from President Trump or the FCC chairman. He went after them, and, you know, like it was nothing. Now, he did kind of get choked up on the fact that he didn't mean to, you know, make light of the assassination of Charlie Kirk.
Here's what he had to say there.
They're telling your followers that our government cannot be allowed to control what we do and do not say on television, and that we have to stand up to it. I've been hearing a lot about what I need to say and do tonight, and the truth is, I don't think what I have to say is going to make much of a difference. If you like me, you like me. If you don't, you don't. I have no illusions about changing anyone's mind. But I do want to make something clear because it's important to me as a human, and that is, you understand that it was never my intention to make light of the murder of a young man. I don't think there's anything funny about it. I posted a message on Instagram on the day he was killed, sending love to his family and asking for compassion, and I meant it, and I still do. Nor was it my intention to blame any specific group for the actions of what it was obviously a deeply disturbed individual. That was really the opposite of the point I was trying to make, but I understand that to some that felt either ill-timed or unclear, or maybe both. And for those who think I did point a finger, I get why you're upset. If the situation was reversed, there's a good chance I'd have felt the same way.
I think he did a good job of apologizing for the comment.
Yes.
Of still saying he didn't agree with what ABC did or how this all went down with the FCC, and being funny and trying to move forward.
Yeah.
I thought it was mostly well done. He kind of did two monologues.
He did.
He kind of addressed the cancellation and everything that surrounded that with the Charlie Kirk stuff. And then he took a break, came back, and then talked about the UN, talked about the autism announcement, things like that. So I thought he did a fine job balancing things out.
A couple times I chuckled. First, when he talked about Ted Cruz, he's like, "And my old pal Ted Cruz." And then he played the bite that we have played on this show. And he said, basically, like, there are strange bedfellows in all of this, but at least people who don't agree with what I have to say, do not like my show, do not like me, came out to say this isn't right when it comes to free speech. And you think, like, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz.
Oh, yeah, he thanked a lot of people.
I don't know. Joe Rogan, whoever did it. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was a good part.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting. But Jimmy Kimmel's back, and he did make mention a couple of different times that there were still big metropolitan areas that weren't carrying the show, because it was yesterday, well after our show was over, that Nexstar then came out and said that they weren't going to air his shows in the markets that they were in that operated ABC affiliates.
Right.
So it was both Sinclair and Nexstar didn't show.
Which accounts for 70 ABC affiliates.
Yeah, he said about 20%.
And I know the president has now threatened to sue ABC. He says something happened between then and now because his audience is gone and his talent was never there. Why would they want to bring someone back who does so poorly, who's not funny, and who puts the network in jeopardy by playing 99% positive Democrat garbage? He is yet another arm of the DNC, and to the best of my knowledge, that would be a major illegal campaign contribution. I think we're going to test ABC out on this. Let's see how we do. Last time I went for them, they gave me $16 million. This one sounds even more lucrative, a true bunch of losers. Let Jimmy Kimmel rot in his bad ratings. That's from the president.
Yeah, and that's where I completely disagree with Donald Trump. I mean, again, I always kind of maintained that this was part economic, part political. You just can't tell a company who they should hire, what shows they should broadcast. That's none of your business.
Yeah, because stay
in your
like,
lane.
Right. Because you don't like what they say.
Stay in your lane.
My
that's
contention
not your lane.
The whole time was this was political. That proves it.
Yeah,
I think.
Federal agents armed with weapons and shields forced their way into a Commerce Township home this week, arresting 36-year-old Joshua Stillman, who now faces federal charges of cyber stalking and interstate extortion. According to court records, Stillman used Instagram accounts, Friend Blender, and This DIY Guy to send AI-generated nude and pornographic images to women, then threatened to post them online unless they responded. One social media influencer targeted in the harassment says she feared for her and her family's safety and took steps to protect herself, including removing personal information and carrying a weapon. The FBI says Stillman also threatened other women with similar tactics. Cybersecurity experts warn that anyone receiving messages like these should not engage. Document the threats and then report them to authorities. And authorities work with multiple FBI offices to identify Stillman, who also has a pending traffic warrant and a recent mental health call. In Livonia, officials say this case highlights the growing danger of AI-driven cyber harassment targeting individuals. We're hearing more and more about these types of deals where people are using AI to, you know, try to get money from people or you know, harass them, stalk them. It's a bad thing right now, And it's a big thing right now.
Very scary. The other story you mentioned off the top was President Trump at the UN. There was a chuckle moment there, too. Unintentionally, I don't know. This made me laugh so much. He's really upset about the escalator and the teleprompter.
All I got from the United Nations was an escalator that on the way up stopped right in the middle. If the first lady wasn't in great shape, she would have fallen. And then a teleprompter that didn't work. These are the two things I got from the United Nations, a bad escalator and a bad teleprompter.
That made me laugh. Genuinely, that was funny. He was really upset.
It was a little levity there.
There is a claim that he thinks that was all done on purpose to make him look bad, so they're looking into it.
Well, that's what Caroline Levitt said on Jesse Waters.
Well, there was some concerning reporting over the weekend from the London Times, as you pointed out, that UN globalist staffers were basically plotting to set up the president of the United States. And first it was the escalator, then it was the teleprompter, and then Katie Pavlich from Town Hall, who we offered a seat in the press pool to cover the president's historic speech today, noticed that the audio inside of the room was much lower and different for the president of the United States than the previous speaker. So
they're looking into that. The Secret Service is looking
into it. They got people looking into it.
Yeah.
They got people looking into it. Ryan Ruth, the attempted assassinator on Donald Trump at his golf club, was sentenced and convicted of all of his charges.
Did you expect anything different, really?
Yesterday, no. It was a pretty open and shut case.
Yeah.
We'll talk a little bit more about that later. The Tigers' epic collapse.
And plus the content of the UN speech too.
Sure. Yeah. I'm trying to get a couple more things in here before we got to go to break. A lot still to talk about today. Coming up next, this meeting between Donald Trump and Democrats as a government shutdown looms is on ice. It's next on JR Morning.
Welcome back to JR Morning. So much news all the time, including will the federal government get a budget in time to prevent a government shutdown?
Oh, just that little thing.
Yeah, that's huge, too. Ryan Schmelz, Fox News correspondent, WJR contributor, on the line with us, roaming the halls of Capitol Hill to get this answer. Ryan, what do you have?
Well, ain't many halls to roam because nobody's here. And, you know, I thought I would have a nice, relaxing Tuesday and nothing would happen yesterday when I took off because of that horrible Ravens game on Monday where that team.
Tweeting that Ravens game. Who won that game?
I don't know. That was the first time in a while.
Did you guys see a horrible game on Monday? I didn't see a horrible game on Monday.
No,
I know.
Yeah.
Not from my view.
Yeah, no, though. The funny thing is, I've watched a lot of Ravens games the last, 5 years, and every time I'm like, man, we really beat ourselves that time. That was the first time I think I actually watched the team just come in there and just beat us. you know, flat up. So good for you. That was a big win for, and a statement win for the Lions.
All right. It pained him to do that, but thank you
very much. We appreciate you, Ryan.
Checks in the mail, Ryan.
Yeah. All right. So on the government funding stuff, right, yesterday was quite an interesting day because you had, President Trump put out on Truth Social that he was canceling this scheduled meeting between him, Chuck Schumer, and Hakeem Jeffries. Pretty much President Trump's justification, and it was a very lengthy one, but he is alleging that the counteroffer that Democrats have put out is just a simple no-go for him. It's very expensive. There's a lot of health care provisions. There's a lot of overturning of the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and President Trump just said, we are not doing that.
Hmm. Well, I know House Speaker Mike Johnson and Senate Majority Leader John Thune, they reportedly encourage the president to cancel. Does that kind of signal that the Republican leaders believe that standing firm is going to strengthen their negotiating position?
It seems like that's kind of been their MO from the start.
Uh-huh.
You know, they put this bill on the floor late last week. It did not pass, and Thune came out almost immediately afterwards and said, well, we're going to put this thing on the floor again, and Democrats can either vote for it or they can't vote for it. It seems like the justification is that, they passed this out of the House. We have a government shutdown that's scheduled for next week, or the funding deadline at least is next week. If you just hold firm, the idea is that Democrats are going to cave on this and just eventually vote for the offer that's on the table. So it's a risky move, but it is a move that has worked in the past.
What kind of pressure is Mike Johnson under, and really all Republicans for that matter? I mean, one of the reasons that Kevin McCarthy got bounced from leadership was because he supported continuing resolutions, and that's something that they're really considering here to avoid this.
Yeah, Speaker Johnson's in a little bit of a better position than McCarthy was.
Well, that's because Matt Gaetz isn't there at the moment.
Matt Gaetz isn't there, and President Trump is there.
Right.
Yeah.
And As Thomas Massey, who's probably the biggest critic of Speaker Johnson in the House, will say, Speaker Johnson has that job as long as President Trump says he wants Speaker Johnson to have that job. Mm. And, I think, too, the Republicans are starting to realize, and they may not have realized this under McCarthy, but they are starting to realize, a lot of them are, just how hard Speaker Johnson's job is when you have a majority like the one he does. So for him to be able to get, the last government funding package through with all Republicans on board, and then to get the One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed, right now he does have a pretty good amount of political capital. So, we'll see if there any pressure comes out of this one. But it seems like with Donald Trump there, Speaker Johnson's job is a lot more safe than McCarthy's was.
And from your reporting, the sticking point is Obamacare and these insurance premiums going up next year. That's what Democrats are trying to put in there and avoid?
That's been the big one, yes. Now, they put out their own plan. There are some people who believe that this is what actually got Republicans to pass it out of the House, because it was so ambitious, where you had there were projections that it would have added $1.5 trillion to the national debt over just 1 year. And that was a big no-no for a lot of Republicans. But yes, it seems like these Affordable Care Act subsidies that would cost about $350 billion over the next 10 years. That's kind of the big, big sticking point that Democrats have kind of latched onto as their negotiating tool. And so far, they haven't been willing to budge off that.
Ryan, I know the president said he's open to meeting with Democrats if they, he says, quote, get serious. Are there any signs of maybe some back channel talks that could break the stalemate?
There are some, I believe, that are ongoing. There's been, the appropriations people usually talk quite a lot. So that's Tom Cole, Rosa DeLauro, who's the top one on the House side, Susan Collins of Maine, Patty Murray of Washington. They do have a lot of communication between the four of them. Now, if they've specifically thought of any plans to avoid a government shutdown related, not quite sure if that's happened, but there are some talks that they have pretty frequently.
So historically, what can we draw from in situations like this? Are we going to see some sort of coming together? Will cooler heads prevail here, or are we going to get some elements of the government shut down?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to figure that out. I mean, this seemed like, I believe some people were comparing this to 2013 when they had a government shutdown. I think probably the most recent one where you had Schumer in Johnson and Trump as the big centerpieces with that one back in, you know, March. I mean, this is pretty much the strategy that Republicans used then, which was that they passed the bill out of the House, despite, you know, people questioning if they could even be able to do that. And then they put it towards the Senate with, you know, just a couple hours left before a shutdown. And you pretty much eventually you saw several Democrats just say, you know what, we'll vote for it, and or at least vote to break the filibuster. And you got upwards of 10 Democrats who decided to support that. And, you know, it seems like Thune and Johnson are banking on that strategy again to work the same way it worked in March. Now, I don't know if Chuck Schumer is going to be the one who caves this time, but all they really need is anywhere between 7 to 10 Democrats to cave, and they can get this thing across the finish line.
Was there any talk of the lawmakers saying, I'll come back and get to work since this is so important?
With this one, I mean, there's probably some who think that way, but, you know, this is part of the strategy. You know, Speaker Johnson's strategy is to pass their bill and then to get out of town and pretty much say, hey, this is the only offer on the table. We think it's a pretty decent one, all things considered. So you can either vote for our bill or you can vote for a government shutdown. The choice is yours. That's the strategy that they're using right now, and we'll see if it works.
And if the government shuts down, we know the American people will feel some pain, but who's most likely to bear the political blame? Is it going to be the president, the Republicans, Democrats?
That's the million-dollar question, right? Because, you know, the Republicans obviously control the House, Senate, and White House, but they do need, you know, Democrats to vote for their bills if they want to fund the government. So I think it really just depends on how the messaging game plays out here. Both sides think that they can win this one. You know, the Republicans are calling this a Schumer shutdown, and they're hoping it stays that way. Because, you know, the Republicans' argument is that they think it's actually a pretty good deal. You know, there's no spending cuts in here. It's a pretty clean extension of government funding. And, you know, they could have gone a little more conservative and cut spending and did those things, and they chose not to. So, you know, they're trying to make the argument that it's a good deal on the table, and we can work on those Obamacare subsidies at a later time.
Well, this story continues. You will be on top of it. Ryan Schmelz, thank you so much. New Lions fan.
Go Lions.
Also.
All right. Go Lions.
Go Lions.
Oh, wow. We got it. Right. Coming up, Trump storms the United Nations. No teleprompter, no filter. What he said next at 6:35.
All right, so Donald Trump in New York City addressed the UN, the General Assembly, yesterday. It's the 80th anniversary of the UN. And there was some criticism that Donald Trump levied to these countries, particularly over their handling of immigration. It's become a flashpoint in many countries, Germany, the UK, even parts of Italy. And that has become an issue there. He also talked a little bit about globalism. We've seen his perspective on the world and where the United States fits into that. And Donald Trump has taken a much more reclusive approach, obviously, with his American First agenda, which is sometimes tried in some of the decisions that the administration is making. But he's urging more countries to do that. We've seen from a NATO perspective on some of the money that he's urging these companies and have them committed over the next several years of getting their defense spending up. But that was a huge portion of what he talked about yesterday until the prompter went out and he had to go off the cuff.
Yeah, he talked a lot about this idea of a Palestinian state, which has been recognized now by Canada, Australia, France.
UK.
And he says this on his opinion on that.
We can't forget October 7th, can we? Now, as if to encourage continued conflict, some of this body is seeking to unilaterally recognize a Palestinian state. The rewards would be too great for Hamas terrorists for their atrocities. This would be a reward for these horrible atrocities.
He's standing pat there.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, and I didn't pull this part where the... But he also said, what's the point of the United Nations? You guys write papers,
right.
You sign the papers, and they have no teeth.
Yeah.
That was a good bite. Also, he talked about immigration, obviously hitting immigration hard in our country, sure. And he tried to hit it hard for the European countries.
They've been invaded by a force of illegal aliens like nobody's ever seen before. Illegal aliens are pouring into Europe. Nobody is ever, and nobody's doing anything to change it, to get them out. It's not sustainable.
So those are some of the main issues. Then there was, after he met with Zelensky.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Zelensky's a little surprised that kind of flipped and kind of, you know, more towards Ukraine and less towards Russia.
Yeah, he took this approach of he believes now that Ukraine can win back the land that Russia had taken, which is it's an interesting turnaround for Donald Trump. Because I think I really believe he tried to get Putin to capitulate. I think he tried to get Putin to cool it, and he obviously has not.
And I think he feels he got played.
Maybe.
By Putin.
Maybe. And I at least appreciate the effort, right? The whole meeting in Alaska, you know, I don't necessarily subscribe to the idea that it was self-serving or this was a bad idea. I think it was a good idea. I think anytime you can get a world leader to talk, particularly in a case of wartime, it's a good thing. And now, for the umpteenth time, Putin showed his butt.
Yeah.
Again.
Again, yeah.
Right? They've had these conversations. Putin says he's going to stop. He doesn't stop. And so Donald Trump finally said enough. We'll see how that evolves over the next couple of weeks, couple of months, however long this goes on. Maybe he flips back and... But as of right now, Zelensky says that there is good relations with the United States.
We have often phone calls and meetings. And I think the fact that Putin was lying to President Trump so many times also made a difference between us.
I think the president was trying to have a good guy and a good guy. Now he has a good guy and a bad guy.
Maybe.
In his mind.
Yeah, sure, maybe.
You know, yeah.
The Truth Social post said, quote, "I think Ukraine, with the support of the European Union, is in a position to fight and win," all caps, "all of Ukraine back in its original form. With time, patience, and the financial support of Europe, and in particular NATO, the original borders from where this war started is very much an option." That is the 180, because they were always talking about sort of ceding land, just getting this war done.
Yeah, yeah.
And he mentioned, you know, how many more lives are going to be lost, right? He's been very focused on the loss of life.
Yes.
Rightfully so. But that's been a main focus for him. Zelensky also talked about, you know, the United States during the Biden administration was very involved with Europe in trying to support Ukraine in any way possible. All the money that was sent. But even Zelensky says that not enough is being done by the European countries in this situation still.
Not enough pressure from the Europe. They are our partners, but it's not enough. We need pressure directly on Putin, on their energy network, on their financing system, on banking system.
So he's still saying, look, we appreciate everything that Europe's doing, but you still need to put pressure on Putin where it hurts.
The president is saying that too.
Absolutely. So now it seems like Trump and Zelensky are aligned on a lot of these issues.
And part of his UN speech also was saying, you have to stop buying to the people in the crowd.
Right.
Stop buying oil from Russia. If you really want to have teeth in this argument and put pressure on them, you have to stop buying oil. The Kremlin rejected all these arguments from what they heard. They said that the economy was stable despite problems in some sectors caused by sanctions, and that Russian forces' slow advance in Ukraine was part of a deliberate strategy rather than a sign of weakness. And they reject Trump's paper tiger comment.
Baloney.
You know that's
crap. I'm calling bull bleep all over that.
You know that's crap.
You know, and look at how that started. Remember that huge procession of military vehicles that they were sending into Ukraine? And then they stalled because they didn't have enough gas to get to where they needed to go.
They were just crappy.
That's not a plan. No war general, no great war mind would go, hey, I have an idea. Let's send all of our military equipment in and then trick them by thinking that we ran out of gas.
No.
It doesn't make any sense.
No, definitely not.
That kind of propaganda can work in Russia, maybe, right, where they need to keep everybody's morale high. They want everybody to think that this war is going their way.
Yeah.
But it's not. To me, it's a ridiculous argument.
I mean, this was supposed to be a 3-day war, right? I mean, it was, you know, it was going to go in 3 days. They were going to take over, you know, Kyiv, and it was going to be over. You're going to oust. I think the United States had even sent a plane over to Ukraine to get Zelensky out. Say, hey, you can come over. You can get out of there because they're going to take it over. But it never happened. He stayed and fought.
Let's switch gears to the Tigers, perhaps, or would you like to talk about Ruth?
Either way. Yeah, let's talk Tigers. It's disappointing.
Oh, my goodness.
What happened here? Now they are dead even with the Guardians, and the Guardians have the tiebreaker. Are the Tigers going to even make the playoffs?
They may not.
And we had Scooble on the mound. Scooble's supposed to be the savior, right? Well, he had some problems there in the sixth inning. They were leading, and then they end up losing 5-2 overall. And so it shows that Scooble is a human.
Yeah, he's not
a machine.
Yeah, he's not a machine. I will say, I put the kids to bed. We were watching the game about 7:45, and I'm like, all right, bedtime. We got to go to bed. So we took the kids to bed. By the time I got back, it was, 5-2? I'm like, what?
Yeah, what happened?
What happened? Yeah. I went back and watched, and it was Steven
Kwan. He happens all the time, and there was a bunt and all this other stuff, and then a balk from Scooble.
It's just uncharacteristic
of him.
It was just collapse. It was just collapse, collapse, collapse. Now they hold their fate in their hands. Now they're tied, so we got a couple more games with them, and then we play Boston. Right, we have 3 games with Boston.
Yep. In that sixth inning, the Guardians scored 3 runs off Tarik Scooble, without a ball leaving the infield.
Mm-hmm.
And without a ball being hit harder than 65 miles an hour. It was small ball.
Wow.
It was small ball. For whatever reason, they cannot beat this team.
Yeah.
They cannot beat them.
They have had their number for a long time.
Yeah, it's crazy what's happening to the Tigers. Do they make the playoffs at this point? I mean, this slide, you got to stop the bleeding at some point.
In a row.
7 in a row, man. Yeah.
It's troubling. Hey, by the way, coming up a little later on, 7:19, we've got your opportunity to win $1,000. Nice little potential perk for you, so make sure you're listening. We'll tell you how you could possibly win that. Meanwhile, 6:44, time for this week's S&P Global Mobility Minute with Mike Wall.
The outlook for the global auto industry has improved somewhat, particularly for North America and Greater China, among other regions. While markets continue to navigate evolving U.S. trade actions and other regional dynamics, the actions and reactions of industry participants influence our forecast revisions for this month. Our assumptions regarding tariffs remain largely intact. However, automaker strategies in mitigating the impacts are becoming more apparent. Companies are increasingly spreading the cost and price impact pragmatically across markets and are adjusting content, trim, and mix accordingly. Additionally, automakers in the U.S. are benefiting from not facing emissions penalties and the need to purchase regulatory credits. The net effect is we are not expecting consumers to bear as much of the burden by way of major price increases, which results in an improved demand and production outlook through the near term. Looking to North America, S&P Global Mobility's latest light vehicle production outlook was upgraded by 212,000 units for 2025 and now stands at 15.2 million units relative to 15.4 million units for 2024, as stronger third and fourth quarter output is anticipated. The U.S. light vehicle sales outlook for 2025 has also been upgraded and now stands at 16 million units, roughly on par with 2024. I'm Mike Wall with this week's Automotive Minute from S&P Global Mobility.
Well, Jimmy Kimmel is back on ABC's late night lineup after nearly a week off the air, and his show was suspended, as you know, following backlash over remarks he made about the assassination of conservative activist Charlie Kirk, a move that sparked a national debate over free speech, corporate responsibility, and political pressure. And help us unpack the communication strategy behind Disney and ABC's decision. We're joined by Matt Friedman. He's co-founder of Tanner Friedman Strategic Communications. Matt, good to have you back on JR Morning.
Good to be back, Lloyd. Thank you.
So did you see any of it last night, the monologue, and what did you think?
Full disclosure, I saw it this morning.
Yeah, a lot of us did.
a little too late. And
yeah.
All this stuff is available online, which is actually a threat to the late-night business model. But that aside, I did watch it this morning. I got about 25 minutes in, and I thought from a messaging standpoint, Kimmel and team did really a terrific job of blending the poignant and very serious aspects of this but remembering that they were still a comedy show and their viewers go there for laughs. And the blending of the two, I think, worked out very well and may get things on track if the government doesn't get in the way or those companies trying to win favor with the government don't get in the way.
So I know Disney said it suspended Kimmel to avoid inflaming a tense situation. Then they reversed course after they got all of this public backlash. Does that sound like careful crisis management to you or a company that just got caught flat-footed?
I think it was something in between. It was definitely not textbook crisis management by any stretch. We still really haven't heard anything from the company other than a couple of statements. So a lot of words have been put in the company's mouth, which is something from the corporate communications side we never want to do in times of adversity or bad news. So people like me have been speaking instead of people from the company, and that's never good. At the same time, they were put in a very difficult situation, something that really has never happened before to anybody in the media industry in this country, in that government strong-arming was putting them in a position where they had to do something from an HR perspective and from a business perspective, and that was difficult. So it definitely has been a rocky week for Disney and ABC, and really probably the best thing that could have happened to let some air out of the balloon is to get Jimmy Kimmel back on TV in the way that he was last night.
Jimmy said it last night that, you know, you have to stand up when you feel like there's government overreach, and lots of people did. There were also protests against Disney and artists saying they wouldn't work with Disney. What do you think was the tipping point for Disney? The subscriptions to Disney Plus going away?
It seems like it was probably all those things, Jamie. And also, and I heard this from a friend of mine on the West Coast last week, there were affiliates that really have nothing but a contractual business relationship with ABC that were getting protests and that were getting angry phone calls, mostly because viewers didn't know how else to vent in their local communities. So they were going after affiliates like ours here in Detroit that are not owned or directly controlled by ABC. So I think it was a lot of public relations factors happening at the same time. Plus, I think they took somebody off the air, probably didn't think completely deserved it, but we'll never know that, or we won't know that till the books come out.
But ABC still has an issue because Nexstar and Sinclair are still preempting his show. So how are they dealing with that internally, do you think?
Well, they have a big issue, Chris, because President of the United States went online last night on the social media platform that he owns and talks about going after ABC. So, yes, Kimmel is back on the air, and yes, everything worked from a production and messaging standpoint, but they have big problems here. They have a president who wants to make a personnel decision for them. They have an FCC that is being strongly lobbied by one of their largest affiliate group owners, Nexstar, that needs the FCC, they say, to approve a merger. There's a lot going on here. This controversy is not over. But at the same time, it's reached a different stage. And one of the things that we look at in crisis management and crisis communications is progress. It's one of the things I ask my clients when we're in crisis is, are we closer today than we were yesterday? If so, we're making progress and that we want to continue on. That's happening, but there's a lot of work left here.
But Nexstar and Sinclair both made that decision before Donald Trump went to social media last night.
That's correct. So I'm pointing out the Trump threat is something that's really significant to them that they can't seem to get away from. But yes, the affiliate issues with clearing this show and Nexstar's desire to win favor of the FCC across the board are things that they're going to have to deal with that have been constants throughout this controversy over the last week.
Speaking with Matt Friedman, co-founder of Tanner Friedman Strategic, and Matt, what lessons do you think other companies take from this when they find themselves kind of caught between their talent and the audience and like government regulators?
Well, I don't think that this is going to go away. This has been a priority of this presidential administration, is a crackdown, for lack of a better word, on the media and a crackdown on what the president doesn't like or the administration feels is counter to their objectives. So it would be easy to single out ABC, but it would be wrong because this could spread. I think one of the things we've learned in this is that the public is starting to get attuned to the value of the First Amendment. And for those of us in this conversation and your advertisers and others who rely on the First Amendment to do what we do, that's potentially a positive outcome of this. Amid all the negativity, is that if the public starts understanding what everybody learned in social studies class and how it works in the real world, that could be an outcome that could benefit everybody as they try to work through this.
Matt Friedman, co-founder of Tanner Friedman Strategic Communications, always great to have you on and get your insight on these matters. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Anytime.
All right. Coming up, a former governor of Michigan throwing a little cold water on Mike Duggan's bid for governor as an independent. I'll tell you who that is coming up next on JR Morning.
7 o'clock hour. It's good to have you. Got your chance to win $1,000 coming up at 7:19. Lots of big stories happening yesterday, including Jimmy Kimmel returning to the airways after a brief pause in his show, Jimmy Kimmel Live. But he's back. And he really went hard in the paint.
He didn't pull any punches.
He addressed. I thought he did a nice job of merging these two worlds that he had to come back to.
Yes.
Obviously, the situation that got him pulled off the air from ABC initially, which was some of his comments revolving around Charlie Kirk's assassination. And they said that they didn't want to inflame anything, so they took him off the air, but now he's back. And I thought he did a nice job of blending some of the current things that have been happening with some of the issues that got him off the air.
Let's hear from him.
This show is not important. What is important is that we get to live in a country that allows us to have a show like this. Yeah! I've had the opportunity to meet and spend time with comedians and talk show hosts from countries like Russia, countries in the Middle East, who tell me they would get thrown in prison for making fun of those in power, and worse than being thrown in prison. They know how lucky we are here. Our freedom to speak is what they admire most about this country. And that's something I'm embarrassed to say I took for granted until they pulled my friend Steven off the air and tried to coerce the affiliates who run our show in the cities that you live in to take my show off the air. That's not legal. That's not American. That is un-American, and it is so dangerous.
Talked a lot about the bigger picture there when it comes to sort of censorship. He talked about apologizing for if that comment inflamed, hurt anybody's feelings. He got emotional at times.
Yeah,
he said that, you know, he didn't mean to hurt anyone or make light of someone's murder, and he thought it was beautiful that Erica Kirk forgave the shooter. And so
a moment over the weekend, a very beautiful moment. I don't know if you saw this on Sunday. Erica Kirk forgave the man who shot her husband. She forgave him. That is an example we should follow. Yeah. If you believe in the teachings of Jesus as I do, there it was. That's it. A selfless act of grace, forgiveness from a grieving widow. It touched me deeply. And I hope it touches many. And if there's anything we should take from this tragedy to carry forward, I hope it can be that and not this.
Yeah. He also said, though, right at the end, he said people wanted to know if I was going to have to, you know, say something specific, you know, that the network wanted me to say something specific. And there is a statement that I have to read from ABC. And he says, please go to this website if you want to reinstate your Hulu and Disney Plus.
Yeah, he pulled out a little piece of paper.
Yeah.
So he's back. And we'll see how this thing plays out. Still not airing on about 20% of ABC stations around the country.
Sinclair and Nexstar stations.
Yeah. Donald Trump's the man who tried to assassinate Donald Trump at his golf club was convicted yesterday on all crimes.
He was in a bizarre scenario where he tried to, after the conviction, like stab himself with a pen.
Yeah, that was a wild development.
And his daughter following after the car. Did you see all that
video?
Yeah. Bizarre. But he is convicted, and the president was asked about if justice was served.
It was really well handled, and it's very important. You can't let things like that happen. Nothing to do with me, but a president or even a person, you can't allow that to happen.
Handled properly.
Former Michigan Governor Rick Snyder expressing skepticism about Detroit Mayor Mike Duggan's independent run for governor next year, even as several of Snyder's longtime allies are backing the mayor. Speaking at a Citizens Research Council of Michigan's annual dinner, Snyder called the independent bid challenging, citing what he described as game theory, where voters may worry a vote for Duggan could inadvertently help a candidate they dislike. And Duggan, who recently left the Democratic Party to run as an independent, fired back, reminding Snyder he doubted his 2013 mayoral run, which Duggan ultimately won. Despite Snyder's caution, many of his former top aides, donors, Republican loyalists, including Richard Beard, ex-chief of staff Dennis Muchmore, and former treasurer Nick Corey, have already contributed to Duggan's campaign, citing his problem-solving approach and bipartisan track record in the city of Detroit. You can't count Mayor Duggan out. I mean, after becoming mayor through a write-in, you know, back in 2013, you can't count him out.
No, but this is a little different.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with people across the state that don't necessarily know who Mike Duggan is.
Especially
obviously,
in the UP up there.
Yeah, yeah. He's working on that pretty hard. He's traveling the state to talk to folks. But then, you know, you get into the math of it all, and it's, well, who is he taking votes from, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is he taking more votes from Democrats? Is he taking more votes from Republicans? And how does that subsequently help or hurt those that are going to win the nomination for those parties?
Well, you know he's getting donations from both sides.
Well, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, everybody hedges their bets in these situations.
Yeah.
Just in the event
that somebody
wins. 7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. Want to win in business these days? Well, Key Wisdom makes clear that you need to really focus on being online as the priority, right? Well, yes, that is indeed a key tenet for being successful these days, but it's not the whole story. While there is no doubt that consumers are looking for the convenience that the online shopping experience offers today, results from a new Harris poll make clear that consumers want more from brands, especially young shoppers. They want authenticity and multi-sensory experiences that feel personal and memorable, and that can be hard to deliver via the online channel alone. In fact, the Harris survey shows that 79% of consumers say online shopping lacks the magic of an in-person shopping experience. Wait, is the brick-and-mortar shopping experience not yet dead? Indeed, it isn't. Further support shows that consumers still value the in-person physical shopping experience. In addition to the Harris poll data, the Return of Touch report presented by Quad, as reported by eMarketer, underscores that that's the case. Within the in-person shopping experience lies the opportunity for brands to lean into tactile, immersive experiences that drive better recall, deeper loyalty, and ultimately higher ROI. Heidi Wadolski, Vice President and Brand Marketing at Quad, says this: consumers today are looking for experiences that go beyond the transaction. They want to feel something. They want surprise, delight, even belonging. In-person shopping is as much about buying as it is about belonging. Nearly 90% of consumers remember engaging physical store experiences, and 71% say those moments deepened their brand loyalty. For Gen Z and millennials, retail is a social experience. In fact, about 3/4 say shopping at a hyped retailer or pop-up feels like being part of a cultural moment. So what to do? What's the key actionable takeaway from this new data? Well, it's that consumers actually want a blend of the two experiences. Perhaps they want to go in-store to touch and feel, and perhaps even try on an item of interest, and yet may actually execute the purchase online or on mobile. Digital and physical integration is the shopping of marketing, especially for Gen Z and other young consumers. So if you're looking for success these days, don't abandon that brick-and-mortar focus just yet. Focus instead on blending online and offline experiences in a way that delivers both the benefits of convenience of the online experience with the greater loyalty and ROI that only the physical shopping experience can offer. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, and that's today's business beat on the Great Voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
All right, 719, got an opportunity for you to win $1,000. Texas Hour's national keyword, bread, to 95819. That's BREAD to 95819. We'll text you back to confirm your entry. Data and messaging rates may apply. Please don't text and drive. You can play five times each weekday for five chances to win. It's 5K a day on 760 WJR. Official contest and more info are at WJR.com. Donald Trump spoke to the General Assembly at the UN in New York yesterday. Let's break it down. Jason Rowe, the principal of Rowe Strategic, joins us. Jason, it's good to have you back.
Wow, what a speech.
Yeah, it was something. It was long. He had some prompter issues, but Donald Trump went off the cuff and hit on a number of issues. What stuck out?
Well, I will tell you what truly stuck out is sitting on the world stage and in front of 200, you know, nations leaders and ambassadors, lecturing them, dressing them down, insulting them, and then shortly thereafter posting a reversal of his position on Ukraine and Russia, which then forced all of those same people to turn around and praise him for coming along with them in support of Zelensky. If you've seen the Zelensky interview, that to itself is priceless, with Brett Baer on Fox News, describing his surprise at the change in position. So somehow Trump was able to go and mock these people to their faces and then force them to praise him for the rest of the day.
Jason, I got to ask you, you know, the president said that the UN only writes strongly worded letters and doesn't actually solve wars. From your perspective, is that a fair criticism, or is that just political theater?
I think it's a very fair criticism, and I think it is a bipartisan criticism for leaders in Washington. All you have to do is look at the Human Rights Council. Here is a body within the United Nations that is supposed to lead on protecting human rights, and they allow some of the worst abusers of human rights on the planet to serve in leadership positions there. The hostility to Israel long predates October 7 and has been a big problem. And if not for the United States, Israel, and some of the Western European countries blocking some of the things that the UN has attempted to do against Israel. And the reality is, even when they've used peacekeepers, peacekeepers are not able to do very much other than maintain a presence. They are not a fighting force. And so the UN is basically an international debating body. And, the U.S. has been one of its primary funders. And I would say historically, they have been a useful validator of the U.S. position on various foreign policy issues. But even before Trump, I would say the UN and the U.S. have parted ways on a number of big issues. And so, criticism of the UN is very fair. It's a bloated, relatively ineffective organization. But it is the one place that the entire world, the developing world and the developed world, get together and try to navigate what's going on geopolitically.
Your thoughts, he went hard on immigration. Let's just hear that bite, Chris, immigration bite.
They've been invaded by a force of illegal aliens like nobody's ever seen before. Illegal aliens are pouring into Europe. Nobody is ever, and nobody's doing anything to change it, to get them out. It's not sustainable.
He either said preceding that or after that, that all your countries are going to hell. Your thoughts on the president saying that at the UN?
Well, I think his audience there, quite frankly, are people within a number of those countries, from the UK to Germany to Denmark. There have been a lot of problems exacerbated by a huge swelling in immigrants into those countries. And some cases, say for Germany and the UK, millions of Muslims that are there now. I think since 2019, now 20% of Denmark's population is foreign born. And, you know, you don't think of the Danes as being a particularly pluralistic society. But there have been a lot of problems because there isn't the kind of assimilation when you have that much immigration that quickly, and you're seeing a lot of unrest, and you are seeing it kind of manifested in conservative nationalist movements in those countries. And it is a big frustration. You see a lot of protests in England and Germany, even seeing some of this in Italy as well. And so I think the audience there were kind of the new right that is emerging within Europe. There's the AfD party that is very strong in Germany and leading in some polls, though there aren't any upcoming elections. The same in the UK. The Tory party is, you know, relegated to a minor third party at this point. And Nigel Farage's Reform UK party is now, you know, leading in polls, though, again, no elections upcoming. So there is a huge rise within Western Europe of a conservative nationalism, and Trump is aligned with that movement. And I think that was who he was talking to.
I mean, even going back to his first term, he was tackling this idea of globalism and casting that aside. And he talked a lot about that again yesterday.
Well, it is. I mean, I would say if there's one thing that Trump has made me rethink as a conservative was my commitment to free trade. And I think more of a global economy. I think it's had some positives in terms of increasing a lot of people's cost of living because we can afford goods and services at very cheap prices compared to, you know, what our parents could afford and what they were able to do. But the expense of that is, you know, an erosion of a manufacturing base, you know, an emergence of, you know, low-skilled labor coming from other countries that have disrupted the education system, the economy, displaced jobs. So I think this rapid globalization over the last 25 years or so has, you know, just it's the absorption of that change. It's too much too fast. And so, you know, it's made me rethink. And I think you do have to require, as immigrants move into your nation, whether it's the United States or others, that there is some sort of assimilation. And so, you know, the pluralism is not a defect of society, but a strength. And when hundreds of thousands and millions of people move in, they concentrate in specific areas, they don't adopt the language or figure out a way culturally to assimilate with some of the nation's values and culture, you're going to have culture clashes. And that's what you're seeing. And I think we do have to slow immigration and make sure that we manage it in a way that it works for both the immigrants and the nations that are absorbing those immigrants.
Jason Rowe, always appreciate the insight. This about face on Ukraine is an interesting one too. Maybe signaling that he's not so invested in the idea that Vladimir Putin is going to change course on this either. So it's something to continue to watch. Appreciate you, Jason. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.
Yeah, you got it. But the idea that Donald Trump has looked at the situation between Ukraine and Russia and said, you know, if we band together and continue to back Ukraine, mm-hmm. that they're going to be able to make up for the lost land that Russia took over and win this war. Meanwhile, coming up next, what's going on with the Tigers? Some interesting news on the alleged assassination of Donald Trump. That person was convicted yesterday. All that and more coming up on JR Morning. So it only took about 2 hours for the jury to convict Ryan Ruth, the man accused of trying to assassinate Donald Trump at his Palm Beach golf course last year down in Florida. He was found guilty on all 5 counts, which included an attempted assassination of a major presidential candidate, using a firearm in furtherance of a crime, assaulting a federal officer, possessing a firearm as a felon, and using a gun with a defaced serial number. He will face life in prison. The real fireworks, I don't think it was much of a surprise that that was the verdict from the jury. It was a pretty open and shut case, but in the reading of what the jury had concluded, Ryan Ruth tried to stab himself in the neck with a pen. He was removed from the courtroom following the reading of that verdict. Now, that pen that he had access to is specifically designed not to injure. So when he tried to stab himself in the neck, all he did was bruise his neck. And then his daughter was shouting in the courtroom, "Dad, yeah. I love you. Don't do anything. I'll get you out of here." He didn't hurt anybody. This is not fair. It's all rigged. You guys are bleep, bleep.
Bleep, bleep, yeah.
And then she was taken out of the courtroom, too.
Yeah.
Four marshals, like, ushered him out after this attempted, you know, harming with the pen. And then, since he was okay, they brought him back in, escorted by marshals, so he could be informed that his sentencing will be on December 18th.
Yeah, shackled and all. But some fireworks there at the end. Again, this guy is not well.
No, he's not.
You're not well. And I understand, again, I don't understand, but he wanted to represent himself. He has no legal experience, no legal education. He has no background of law, but he wanted to represent himself, and it obviously didn't go well, but.
Yeah, well.
It never goes well. It's never a good idea.
It's never a good idea.
He said, "I wanted to kill. My actions within the community and toward my coworkers and family should show my obvious nonviolence and gentleness." He was speaking about himself in third person, and he said the shooting was never going to happen because it was never in his heart. But the prosecutor said that he spent weeks plotting to kill President Trump, who was running for president at the time. And, you know, they laid out his actions ahead of the incident, and, you know, they said those are not coincidences. It was a plan, you know, but this guy was plotted. He had plotted it.
He went there 17 times.
Yes.
To check it out.
Yeah.
Because he's just a kind, cold-hearted soul.
But it wasn't in his heart.
Okay.
And it was 55 minutes of his closing arguments. He also said that the defendant, meaning himself, lacks the capacity to kill. The prime opportunity was there for the defendant to shoot the president. Why was the trigger not pulled? And he said that any evidence suggesting that the Secret Service spotted him or that he brandished a rifle was a blatant fabrication. It was just an individual on the fence with a gun resting there, he told the jurors.
Every time I hear the word brandish, I think of journalism school when people say, like, nobody speaks like that except cops.
Cops, that's it.
You know, and so Chris, they always were like, you don't say brandished. Because no one talks like that. Okay. Yeah. And so every time I hear that word, I think brandish. Of like 2007.
Yeah. Well, now this part I did know. Prosecutors alleged in court filings that Routh attempted to acquire an anti-aircraft weapon to shoot down the president's plane.
Sure. What's the justification for that? Just a guy with an anti-aircraft missile launcher? Just a guy just sitting there?
Yes. Yeah, right.
Where do you buy that?
I don't think they sell it at Costco.
I don't think so. I don't think you can get it from Amazon either.
No, yeah, it's probably not on Amazon.
Uh-uh.
The UN was gathering in New York. And whenever the president is traveling, you know, he travels heavy. Yeah. He's got a motorcade.
Yes.
Well, this was funny, I thought. Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, was obviously in town. And he was tied up. He couldn't cross the street because everything was blocked off for Donald Trump, so he just decided to call him.
How are you? Guess what? I'm waiting in the street because everything is frozen for you. No, I have 10 people with me. I go to the French embassy.
I'm sorry, I'm president. I'm really sorry. It's just that everything's in frozen right now. There's a border kick coming away. That's why.
Oh, sorry. If you don't see it, let me cross. I negotiate with you.
All right, maybe I underestimated how difficult that would be to understand. But that is Emmanuel Macron standing on a street corner, calling Donald Trump saying, "Hey, I can't get through because you've got everything blocked off. We're waiting for you."
Right.
And he's talking to this poor New York City police officer, the traffic guy there.
He says, I'm sorry, Mr. President. I'm sorry. He can't get through.
I'm really sorry. You cannot get through here.
I think it's funny.
It's cute.
Yeah. I mean, why was he just walking around, though?
Right.
Where's his motorcade?
Exactly.
I mean, you know, maybe he needed a piece of pizza. Just wanted to get a hot dog. I don't know what he's doing just walking around the streets of New York. Also a scary situation at the Tigers game last night. So they lost, which was unfortunate.
Scary things sure was. Going on there.
Yeah, not just the obvious.
But scary moment when Tarek Skubal hit a member of the Cleveland Guardians, the pitcher, David Fry, who was up to bat. He was going in for a bunt, and Skubal threw a 99-mile-an-hour heater in, and it hit David Fry in the face.
But didn't it hit the bat first and then pop up into his
face? I think it hit the barrel of the bat first. Yeah. Uh-huh. And popped up and hit him in the face. And here was the call from the Guardians broadcast on television.
He squares. He tried to bunt, and it hit the bat and then hit him in the face. Or did it hit him square in the face?
I don't know.
I'm not sure. It's not good.
Skubal threw his hat and glove down as soon as he threw the pitch and saw what happened.
It was a scary moment.
It really was.
He went down hard, and you heard that there. Skubal tossed his glove, tossed his hat, put his hands over his face because he knew what yeah. happened there. And it was a very scary moment. David Fry went down. He got some treatment. He was carted off the field. He was able to stand up. But that was a really scary moment in an ugly loss for the Tigers, but just a scary moment.
And it kind of just, you know, it was a domino effect. It just kind of went kind of down from there.
This will be the most epic collapse, I don't know, in Detroit sports. If they don't make the playoffs at all, they had a double-digit 15-point or game lead in the division, and they've lost 11 of 12. They're tied now with the Guardians with five games left, and the Guardians have the tiebreaker.
July 8th was 15.5 games.
Wow.
July 8th. Jason, you're the resident
statistician
Tiger slap here. Where are you at on all of this?
I wasn't very confident with them in the playoffs this year anyway.
Okay.
Because
don't justify it. No.
Oh, he's just saying he didn't think they'd make a run.
Yeah.
Okay. I think they'd make a run. Make
yeah, they're not going to win the World Series. Okay.
The pitching isn't the same. You got Skubal, and you got who knows what you're going to get out of Flaherty.
That's right.
Mize, he's a young guy. The bullpen's not the same this year, and the offense has died.
They can't hit the ball.
Not at all.
I mean, last night was brutal, especially after they found themselves in that hole. They could not hit the ball.
No.
So your confidence level of them making the playoffs is?
Right now?
Yeah.
Confidence level, percentage-wise?
Just making the playoffs.
I'll say 30%.
Yikes.
Well, that's what Andy Dierks, I think it was Dierks, talking about it last night, being like, you could see the frustration on the batters' faces. Like, mm-hmm. guys who are usually upbeat, positive, smiley, their body language is showing
it's
that
different.
They feel it.
Yeah.
It's the building blocks bill. It's being kicked around in Lansing, and it could help parents here in the state. We'll talk about it next here on JR Morning.
As we know, childcare is largely inaccessible and unaffordable. 51% of Americans live in a childcare desert. Addressing that problem in Lansing is the topic of today's Capital Report, sponsored by the Michigan Chamber of Commerce. And, you know, I was just in a park with my daughter when uh-huh. I saw a group setting up with a tent mm-hmm. and it turned out to be Abby Jacobs from Chamber of Mothers, the local chapter, which is this nonpartisan grassroots group that works with mothers and kids, and Senator Kevin Hertel. I'm like, oh, what are you doing in my park over there? And they are trying to work together, building blocks for addressing this issue in our state. And we're joined by Senator Hertel and Abby Jacobs both. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Jamie. Great to be with you.
Nice to see you on that warm day at the park. Let's start with Senator Hertel. You have these building blocks. You want to address this problem in our state. How are you doing it?
Yeah, so not only as a legislator, but as a parent, I have dealt with the same challenges that so many across our community are dealing with. And that's why we had the event that we ran into you at with Abby and her organization, because we've heard from families across not only my district, but across the state, that they are struggling with the high cost of childcare, with just finding access to childcare, and affording all of the basic essentials while building a family. And so we introduced three main elements in a building box plan. The bills have been introduced in the state Senate, and we're working to get them done, but also they all have a budget impact, right? And so we're trying to make sure they're included in the budget. And those are a child tax credit, which we have talked about on this show before, a $5,500 tax credit for families with children under the age of three. RX Kids, which is a very successful program that had started in Flint in the Upper Peninsula, has now expanded to about 10 communities, and we're working to grow that across the state, which creates a $1,500 payment to moms when they are pregnant and a $500 payment every month for either 6 to 12 months, depending on the community buy-in. And a TriShare program as well, which is focused directly at childcare. It's a one-third share between employees, employers, and the state to help families pay for childcare across the state. And it also opens up slots across the state for kids to have access to, for their parents to have access to, so they can go to work and participate in our economy.
And Senator, the legislation aims, I know, to reach families in every corner of the state. How do you make sure that, you know, rural and urban and suburban parents all benefit equitably from this?
Well, that, when our kids launched, the first two pilot communities were Flint and the Upper Peninsula. Very different communities, but they share one common theme, and that's they have childcare deserts. They have communities that have a lot of needs, both from the healthcare standpoint as well as financial needs. And so we wanted to pilot these programs in places where we know they can make the most benefit, and we've seen the success. And so there's no doubt, from the Upper Peninsula to down in my district in Southeast Michigan, every family, as they're deciding to have children or have started a family, they're experiencing these challenges, and we need to do everything we can to cut the costs, to improve access to affordable child care, and create opportunities for parents and kids across our state.
You know, one of the things here, Senator, that that you're looking to address in this legislation is updating licensing requirements for child care centers and facilities. Why the need to address that? And then how does that then create more opportunities for people and more opportunities for them to find child care for their kids?
You know, we've talked to a lot of folks across the state who want to open up child care facilities. I've met with the daycare or preschool that my child was in at a time and talked about some of the onerous regulations that exist that make it really hard for them to either open or operate after they have opened. And a lot of it is really, duplicative red tape that, makes it very challenging for people to even get into the business of operating a child care. And we want to make sure that we do it in the right way so that children are safe when they're in these facilities. But we don't want to make it so burdensome that people cannot operate, or it's so unaffordable to operate that they can't get by, or they have to pass that cost on to families. And so we're working with MyLeap, a department in state government that oversees these programs, to try to reduce those licensing requirements, remove unnecessary barriers, and really with the goal to open up more of these childcare slots across the state so that parents and kids have access to them, but hopefully that also drives the cost down.
Abby, Chamber of Mothers, you were there at this event where I met you and Senator Hertel. And how did you link up with Senator Hertel? And where do you think we are as a state when it comes to supporting mothers and childcare?
Yes. So we linked up with Senator Hertel because I am a member of his district. And so had gotten in touch with a member of his team just about our chapter and what we're looking to do here in Michigan. And for us as a chapter, we are, based here Southeast Michigan, so we cover more than just Senator Hertel's district. But the common theme for our chapter, which was established last year, is that childcare is expensive. This is what our chapter members indicated they wanted to focus on. It's a significant contributor to stress as in their families, and is a significant reason why people are choosing not to have additional children, myself included. And so with Senator Hertel, being my representative, we were able to coordinate this playground meetup, which we met you at, really with the goal of opening the door and continue to build conversations with our chapter members, with their representatives, because with packages like the Building Blocks package that Senator Hertel is speaking on today, we want to be able to voice our concerns and our priorities in that room so that when these things are implemented, that they're really taking into account the experiences of real parents who, are having to sign up on wait lists for child care centers before they are pregnant or even pregnant, or also are spending, significantly more than their mortgage every month just to put their children through childcare. So I think for us, what we're seeing across Michigan is people are not only struggling to afford it, but also find it. Mm-hmm. The accessibility is also key and is a huge part of where some of the licensing requirements that we were all just speaking on come into play, because it allows more centers to open, making it easier for parents to find childcare for their kids.
Senator, we got about a minute left. If these bills pass, what would success look like in, let's say, a year or two from now for a typical Michigan family?
Well, you know, we lose about $2.8 billion annually in economic activity across the state of Michigan simply because we don't have enough access to childcare. And that means that parents cannot participate in the workplace. It creates all kinds of ripple effects across our state. And so while I think this is the right thing to do for families, as I said, I've experienced it as a parent myself. These costs are simply just too high. So we need to make sure we're driving down those costs or helping families afford those costs. Opening up more access to childcare, giving parents and children the resources they need to be successful, that's what will benefit our state long term in the future. Mm-hmm. And I just want to note that while there's a cost to all of these programs, there is a huge cost to not taking action and helping in this area, helping families across the state, because the cost will all show up somewhere else down the line. Mm-hmm. And so I think we need to be smart with the resources that we have, make sure we're addressing the needs of families across our state in this way, and it will pay dividends down the road.
Senator Hertel, Abby Jacobs, thank you both for joining us for Capitol Report.
Thank you for having us.
And I just want to give a shout out to our daycare provider, Donna. We love you. Thank you for doing what you do.
Donna.
Shout out to Donna. All right, coming up on JR Morning, Jimmy Kimmel returned to ABC. Tears, jokes, and a monologue. We'll talk about it.
It's good to have you this morning. Still a little fog lingering downtown.
We've had a beautiful summer and fall. This week's been gloomy.
It's been a little gloomy.
A little gloomy, rainy, but I'm sure the grass is saying, yay.
Yeah, my grass
been screaming.
I generally, in this kind of weather, I just power down.
Okay. Uh-huh.
It's like rainy, gray. It just tends to lead to a little more of like a
nap.
Yeah. Just a little bit more laid back. Just trying to take it easy a little bit.
You do nap well in this weather, though. You do. You
open the window.
Oh, God, yeah.
A little breeze, hear the rain.
Oh, man.
Yeah, there's
all of the above.
Nothing quite like that.
No.
Jimmy Kimmel returned to the airways last night and kicked things off like this.
As I was saying before I was interrupted. If you're just joining us, we are preempting your regularly scheduled encore episode of Celebrity Family Feud to bring you this special report. I'm happy to be here tonight with you.
Raucous crowd for his return.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's gotten 7 million views on that YouTube that he put up of his monologue since he returned. I think he did a good job of weaving a, I'm sorry if I hurt anyone's feelings, that mm-hmm. was not my intent, to, you know what we should do? We should do what Erica Kirk says we should do and forgive our enemies.
Mm-hmm.
To having some fun and being jokey with, what's the sidekick's name?
Oh, Guillermo.
Guillermo.
Yeah.
I thought it was a good weaving of all three of those things.
I thought it was funny at one point. He said, Jimmy's the greatest. Like, we need Jimmy around. Like, this mm-hmm. is awesome. And Jimmy Kimmel was like, well, then why am I getting calls from, other people telling me that you're trying to get on their shows? And he goes, oh, that's a different, it must be a different Mexican. I don't know. Like, it was cute. And he's a great character on the show. But he did talk a little bit about, in the immediate aftermath of the Charlie Kirk assassination, some of the comments he made, he said he didn't mean to trivialize what happened.
We're telling your followers that our government cannot be allowed to control what we do and do not say on television, and that we have to stand up to it. I've been hearing a lot about what I need to say and do tonight, and the truth is, I don't think what I have to say is going to make much of a difference. If you like me, you like me. If you don't, you don't. I have no illusions about changing anyone's mind. But I do want to make something clear, because it's important to me as a human, and that is, you understand that it was never my intention to make light of the murder
of a young man.
I don't
think there's anything funny about it. I posted a message on Instagram on the day he was killed, sending love to his family and asking for compassion, and I meant it, and I still do. Nor was it my intention to blame any specific group for the actions of what it was obviously a deeply disturbed individual. That was really the opposite of the point I was trying to make, but I understand that to some that felt either ill-timed or unclear, or maybe both. And for those who think I did point a finger, I get why you're upset. If the situation was reversed, there's a good chance I'd have felt the same way.
Mm-hmm. So I thought that was heartfelt, and I thought his original comment wasn't trying to trivialize the murder of Charlie Kirk, but in any respect, he said in that moment, if I hurt people, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
There was an interesting piece by Brett Stevens in the New York Times. He's an op-ed writer there. Now the left cares about free speech again. He cited a couple instances of Amy Klobuchar, for example, in Congress, talking about Charlie Kirk's murder and cracking down on speech online. She said, I'm not for censorship, but I do think that more needs to be done online to make sure that people aren't inflaming the beliefs or radicalizing others. There was another instance, even going back to COVID, where people were being censored for some of their positions on particularly the COVID vaccine. So he's saying that there is a double standard here, that now the left, because of what happened to Jimmy Kimmel, they see an opportunity to jump on top of it, and they have.
Well, I think if you're for free speech, it shouldn't matter what the content is. And so some of the people saying, like, well, Jimmy Kimmel's not funny, he shouldn't be on. It's not the point.
It's irrelevant if Jimmy Kimmel is funny or not.
No, it makes no difference.
And so, yeah, if there was a double standard, that's not okay. Hypocrisy is not okay. And so if we use this moment to take a look at free speech and what we allow and what we don't, I think it's a good thing. I think it's a bad thing if the president tweets out that he's going to go after ABC now. That makes it purely political. He said that, I think we're going to test ABC out on this. Let's see how we do. Last time I went after him, I got $16 million. This sounds more lucrative.
And that was CBS.
Really?
Yeah. That was...
No, he got money from
Stephanopoulos.
From Stephanopoulos. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I think that that's wrong as well. I mean, that's not the president's job. He says that what ABC is doing is tantamount to some sort of election interference or as a talking piece for the Democratic Party.
A donation to the DNC.
That's not your lane. That's not your lane. You are the presider. You are the president. That's not your business. What ABC does with their content, with their talent, with their people, their employees, that's their business.
There's also different standards for the news organization than for Jimmy Kimmel entertainment show at 11:30.
Mm-hmm. Well, ABC there's oversight from the FCC. Whereas if you're a cable news network, there is less oversight.
Right.
The FCC has more
oversight over local, not national
Jimmy
Correct.
Kimmel.
That's right.
Correct. So there's that at play too, but I think the president's wrong there. I don't think it's appropriate, quite frankly.
A lot of late night talk show hosts from years gone by would have been taken off a long time ago. All of the presidents that they talked about and said bad things about, and you know, nobody ever came after. And the one that comes to mind, a lot of late night hosts talked about Bill Clinton during the whole Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah,
show,
every night, sure.
You know, and nobody. Hey, you guys know about the Winter Blast. Well, after two decades, the Winter Blast Festival is ending as a standalone event, but fans won't have to miss out on some of those most popular attractions. Organizers say ice sculptures and carnival rides and the zip line will now be part of Royal Oak Holiday Celebration, which runs from November 21st to December 21st over five consecutive weekends in downtown Royal Oak. The expanded holiday event kicks off with a tree lighting ceremony and live music, skating exhibitions, marshmallow roasting, Santa arriving on a fire truck. Each weekend will have a unique theme, including a thrill weekend with zip line rides, shop and sweets weekend with holiday markets and cookie crawls, and giving a gliding weekend with free skating and a toy drive, and Grinch and Games weekend featuring ice sculptures and holiday games. So Royal Oak officials say merging the Winter Blast and the Royal Oak Holidays, it really makes the celebration bigger and more accessible, and it extends the festival fun over a longer period of time for families to enjoy.
My Winter Blast story, when I was in the news department, Dick Hafner sent me over to Winter Blast to do a story.
Okay.
And so he's like, get some audio, talk to some people, whatever. All right, fine.
Okay.
So I go over and I do the zip line. And I'm recording on my phone the audio.
Okay.
And it was very obvious that I was very uncomfortable on the zip line. I'm like,
did you scream?
The little
it's getting
zip line.
Hot in here. It was, yeah, it's not.
A little
it's,
tiny zip
it
line.
Wasn't, it wasn't a large zip line. But the whole time, I'm just like, no!
Oh, boy.
And so I brought it back. And, you know, going back to journalism, like, you're not the story, right? You're covering the event.
Yes.
You're not supposed to be.
No.
Sometimes you can be.
Standards have changed.
It turned out that I was a bit of that story, unfortunately. it was fun. Winter Blast, it was a great time.
Yeah,
for a lot of folks. Meanwhile, coming up at 8:49, we've got Name That Tune today, and we've got tickets to Andre Bocelli December 7th at Little Caesars Arena that we'll be able to hopefully give away at 8:49. Charlie Kirk was all about dialogue, and that is the discussion of our next segment, where young politicians, those aspiring to get in the game, are talking. It's next on JR Morning. So in the wake of the Charlie Kirk assassination, we talked as a show and thought it was a good idea to start ushering in this new conversation, particularly among members of both sides of the party.
Yeah.
Just to create that discourse, to create that ability to have those conversations, agree disagreeably.
Well, that's what Charlie Kirk did, right? When he went on these college campuses, he wanted to be disagreed with, and it was going to be okay if you ended the conversation still in disagreement. And so we thought, okay, let's get people from both sides.
And while we're still seeing a lot of the same song and dance from a lot of the established politicians, there's two groups here in Michigan that are coming together. It's the Michigan Young Republicans and the Young Democrats of Michigan. They released a joint statement condemning the assassination of Charlie Kirk and all forms of political violence. They've gotten together and they have agreed to disagree agreeably and have those civil conversations. And we've got James Asher, who's the communications director for Michigan Young Republicans, on the phone. We'll connect with him momentarily. But Austin Marsman, the chair of the Young Democrats of Michigan, joins us here in studio. It's great to see you, Austin.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
How did this idea come about to release this joint statement in the wake of what happened to Charlie Kirk?
You know, like so many people, we found out about this through our phones. And as young people, we did what we do. We connect. And we connected with the Young Republicans and said, you know, violence is bad. Let's put something out there. Let's lead by example. There's a lot of noise right now. And we thought it was really smart to put something out to our members, to the public, and say, violence is bad.
So how did you get to the point where you were releasing this? What did those conversations look like?
Essentially, we opened a Google Doc and started to put words on paper. We thought it was important to say we disagree on policy, but we can agree that political violence is bad no matter what your views are.
You reached out, or James reached out to you, that part doesn't matter, but you hadn't talked to James Asher, the director for Michigan Young Republicans, before. What was your conversation like?
It was pleasant. We connected. We kind of knew of each other, I would say, but really focused on the work that we were each doing. I don't know for sure, but I'm new to my role. With the Young Dems, we just got elected earlier this year. So it was good to connect, and I look forward to what we can do in the future to bring people together.
I know social media often accelerates, you know, outrage and also misinformation. Talk about some practical steps that you know, both of you guys can take to kind of cool things down in those spaces.
Absolutely. It starts with us, right? It starts with folks who have the microphone. You know, we gotta figure out what we're saying. It's like when you're raising kids, right? It's all about everybody and in our different circles of influence, I would say.
Mm-hmm. How do you approach social media? When you and I talked about how we saw the horrible video, I didn't want to see it. It just came up on my feed. How are we going to deal with this going forward? Because it does inflame.
Yeah,
it's so hard. I mean, we have to ask ourselves, who benefits from this? You know, we open up our phones and see so much day to day. who benefits from that outrage and that anger? I've personally like been able to go outside and can reconnect with friends and family, and I find that more beneficial than scrolling endlessly and getting more upset. So I think the more we could do to reconnect and have real life conversations.
Touch grass, as Spencer Cox said.
Yeah. Yeah. I actually got a sweatshirt the other day that says touch grass. I think that's a great saying.
Yeah.
And so now what do you want to see this relationship between young Republicans and young Democrats? How do you want to see this evolve?
You know, we're young people. We're going to be in this for a long time, probably. Probably some of us will serve together at some point. So I think keeping that line of communication open and maybe even on a personal level, like, hey, how are you doing? How's your family doing? Before we even start to talk about policy, building that relationship, I think, is how we can build bridges and move Michigan forward.
That is what's crazy is you're talking about that as like a new idea. That is not a new idea. You go back 20 years ago, that's how things were.
Yeah.
You had the politics side of things, but then you had the personal side of things. People were curious about how your family was. Oh, your daughter just had a baby. How's everything? And and then you could separate. You could separate those two things. So the fact that you're bringing that back, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah, you know, when I ran for office last year in 2024, I ran in a swing seat, and people were asking, you know, are you concerned about your safety? And unfortunately, the answer was yes.
You were.
Yes, I was. So we have to do a better job of bringing that that temperature down and connecting with people on the issues that matter.
What lessons can your generation teach these older, you know, political leaders about listening and compromise and just civility?
You know, like I said, it's having those conversations. I also served on my local school board growing up, and I was the youngest elected official that anyone had ever seen over there.
Growing up, you're 25.
Yeah. I'm still growing up, right? Like, yeah. That frontal lobe is. But no, seriously, I was 21 when I got elected, and being able to talk to folks about the issues that mattered and in a way that sometimes surprised people, I think our two organizations have the potential to lead in that. So
you have this joint statement that, you know, you guys are going to disagree agreeably, right? Mm-hmm. What now moving forward? Is there anything else you guys could do together as organizations?
We haven't talked about that yet.
Okay.
We're all volunteers, right?
Yeah. You have day jobs?
Right. We have day jobs. So we'll see. But, you know, 2026, all eyes are on Michigan. So we'll see where that goes and how we can move forward.
Is there ever frustration from you? I know you can't speak for young Republicans, and we're trying to connect with James Asher. Is there any frustration that you're not seeing that on a higher level, that you're not seeing these established politicians take the same actions?
Yes, it's really frustrating. I seeing certain politicians blame the, quote, radical left for what happened to Charlie Kirk. We can't do that. We really have to just condemn violence, bring that temperature down, not inflame the rhetoric we're seeing, even from, you know, both sides. We have to do better. I was proud to campaign with Senator Slotkin when we were in 2024. And before we even talked about politics, it was, hey, how are you? Like, what's going on? I really valued that. And I think that's how we bring the temperature down, is connecting with people on a personal level first. And realizing they're not our enemies. They might disagree with us, but they're not our enemies.
And I just think, even though you and the Michigan Young Republicans may have different ideologies, just the fact that you guys are talking and listening, because that's the thing. You know, sometimes we talk too much and we don't listen enough. That's why we have two ears and one mouth. And so I think just the talking, you may be able to find some common ground or find something even totally different that you guys can come around and really agree on.
Yeah. Let me be clear. We vehemently disagree on so many things, right? Like, we can talk about the economy and civil rights and all of those things, but there are areas we do agree on, right? Mm-hmm. You know, in the environment, right? That seems to be a bipartisan issue until, you know, at a certain point.
Yeah.
But when we're seeing such a high level of political violence, the highest since the 1970s, it's up to those of us with a microphone to really say, hey, violence is bad.
Yeah.
Right. And you know, young people to take the mantle.
Yeah, certainly. Alex Marsman with the Young Democrats of Michigan. We hope to have you back on again very soon with
James
Asher.
Yeah.
And we'll talk to you. Thanks for coming.
Thank you
so much. Appreciate it. We'll take a break. More next.
Well, the Michigan political race is already heating up with controversy after a Republican candidate for statewide office posted a fake video online falsely depicting a U.S. Senate hopeful setting fire to a chair inside Detroit's Guardian building. The clip, created with artificial intelligence, targeted Democrat Abdul El-Sayed and has sparked some new concerns about deepfakes and disinformation and the rising temperature of political rhetoric. And joining us now to talk about the incident and what it means for voters in Michigan is Senate candidate Abdul El-Sayed. Abdul, thank you for coming back on JR Morning.
Thanks for having me, and I'm sorry to have to talk about this with you.
I know. And before we get into the details of the incident, what went through your mind when you first saw that fake video of yourself circulating online?
What a sad reality it is when people use fake disinformation for political gain. And you know, we want to have a real conversation about the issues at hand, about how we make healthcare more affordable, about how we make sure we can afford our prescription drugs, about how we can make sure that a trip to the grocery store doesn't cost you hundreds of dollars just to feed your family, about how to make sure people can afford a home and stay in their home if they're over 65, not whether or not somebody made a fake video of me setting fire to a chair. And, you know, it's sad because, like, this is where our conversation has gone. And you ask yourself, why do these problems just keep getting worse? Because we're not having serious conversations about how to fix them.
Now, the video was defended as obvious fiction and satire. But from your perspective, what's the line between protected political satire and just some dangerous misinformation?
Well, you got to ask yourself, why make it if it was so obviously political satire? Why can't you find the words to say what you want to say about how you might disagree with my positions? And I'd ask you, what do you disagree about? Do you disagree that groceries are too expensive? Do you disagree that housing is unaffordable or unattainable? Do you disagree that healthcare should be less expensive? But instead, people are just using these new technological tools to miss and disinform the public because they can't actually find the words to make an argument. And in this moment where we're watching this political violence seems to be on the rise, I think all of us have a responsibility to bring the temperature down, not literally heat it up with a fake video of somebody setting a chair on fire in a building. So I think we've got to, all of us have a responsibility to get back to the issues. Michiganders deserve so much better. Folks are struggling. I've been to 57 different cities now, 100 different rooms. No matter where I go, people tell me it shouldn't be this hard. And what they don't need is AI fake slop videos polluting our conversation. They need real, hard-earned wisdom about how we fix things and folks who are willing to engage in the conversation about how to actually do that.
You know, we talked to Kevin Kievsky yesterday here on the show about this, and he pointed to one thing that you said in particular at a campaign event this month when you said, when they go low, we don't go high. We take them to the mud and choke them out. He said that basically you were kind of what the video depicted, setting fire to something and walking away. What is your response to that?
That's kind of silly. He made a video depicting me setting fire to something, and he's upset about political metaphor. You know, in politics, we talk about fighting them and beating them all the time. And I think in this moment, all of us have a responsibility to step back and ask, well, is that the best language? And, you know, we're asking the same thing on our campaign. But then to use that argument to make it worse by literally creating a video of somebody setting something on fire that he knows a lot of people are going to misread as real is really quite dangerous. So the argument of he did it first, I just think is just so immature. And look, at the end of the day, none of it is making people's groceries less expensive. None of it is fixing our healthcare system. That's what I'm focused on. I want to go high. And I wrote a book about how to fix healthcare costs. My work has been about putting glasses on kids' faces and eliminating medical debt. That's what we should be talking about right now. And I would encourage anybody who wants to be elected statewide in this state to be focused on the things that they're hearing on the campaign trail from folks who are in pain. That's what we're doing, and that's what we're going to be focused on.
We just had young Democrats and young Republicans talking about how they are coming together. Is there a way for politicians and people seeking office to do better here?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think all of us need to be focused on the people we are serving. Michiganders are good people who go to work every day trying to secure a good life for their loved ones, for their kids. I think if we were to root more of our conversation in the challenges Michiganders face in the kindness and decency that Michiganders bring to their lives every day, I think we'd all do better. And, you know, that's what we're really committed to. I think for all of us right now, thinking about where we are, thinking about the young people who might be looking up to us and taking their cues from us. I think all of us need to be thinking about how do we model the kind of engagement, the kind of behavior, the kind of political discourse that our framers really built this place around and that Michiganders can model in their lives every single day.
Dr. El-Sayed, I got to ask you about what the president was talking about yesterday when he was trying to put together acetaminophen and Tylenol with autism. Your thoughts on that and what he said about not taking it at all if you're pregnant?
Yeah, it's dangerous because it's not based in what the science says. You know, we've seen a threefold increase in autism diagnosis over the past 25 years. Do we really think that's because there's a threefold increase in people taking Tylenol during pregnancy? I think it just doesn't even pass the whiff test. But what's worse is that people don't take Tylenol because they feel like it. They take Tylenol because they have inflammation that's causing them pain. And other forms of anti-inflammatories and pain medications are contraindicated. They're not recommended. In fact, they're recommended against in pregnancy. So he's basically asking pregnant women to go with inflammation that is untreated. And that itself can be very dangerous. In fact, some of the studies that we've looked at that they're misinterpreting here may actually be showing us that it's the inflammation for which people take the Tylenol that may actually be causing the increased risk of autism. So this is just really dangerous. And you got a guy who doesn't know the first thing about healthcare trying to pretend that all of a sudden in 5 months they found the answer and all will be well. What I worry about is that this is both false blame and false hope, and both of them are really dangerous. This is not a victimless crime when you claim an answer to something that that isn't in fact based in science. And so I think it's really dangerous. I think people need to go talk to their doctors instead of listening to a president who doesn't know the first thing about healthcare or a HHS secretary who literally takes his grandkids swimming in creeks that are polluted. So I worry a lot about what this climate of disinformation is going to mean for the choices that people make around protecting themselves and their loved ones' health.
All right, Dr. Abdul El-Sayed, appreciate your time. He's a Michigan Senate candidate. Thanks for coming on this morning.
I appreciate you having me, and thank you again.
All right, and coming up, it is Name That Tune Wednesday. What tunes will we be naming, and what is the category this time?
I don't know.
Looking forward to it.
Jason always dials something up for us.
That's next.